I am so excited for you guys to hear today's episode with my guest, Steve Hager. Steve Hager is a guy I've known about 10 years, ever since I did some video work for him at High Times Magazine, where he was the editor-in-chief. He is a fascinating, incredibly interesting filmmaker, writer, producer, musician. He does it all. He's the hippie king, and he has been a guy that inspired me a lot over the years, especially during the time when we worked together. But a lot of the things that I picked up from him, a lot of ideas that I learned from him, a lot of things that he taught me about have carried over and really changed the way that I looked at the world and how I continue to look at the world 10 years later. So I'm super, super excited for you guys to hear this conversation that I had with Steve at his home in New Jersey. Great little coastal town in New Jersey where he lives. We won't give you too much of detail where he is, because I don't need anybody dropping in on Steve and his little paradise. But I think you guys will really enjoy it. Unfortunately, the first 10 or 15 minutes of the show, there was apparently some audio issues in the recording, and it seems as though my mic was recording sort of the room sound, even though we were in the backyard area, in Steve's spa area. It was sort of recording it was a room mic, so it was recording everything, which was really cool, actually. You hear his wind chimes going and his birds going and the water flowing in his little garden area. But it doesn't give you the crispest audio on his voice. But I did something. By the way, my excuse for that is I was super high. Steve, of course, Mr. High Times, Mr. Cannabis Cup, the creator of the Cannabis Cup. First thing he did when I got there was hand me a joint. So I was a little bit stoned, not gonna lie, when I sat down to record, and apparently just didn't press one particular button. But I figured it out about 15 minutes in. I should have taken the advice of my friend Guy Fiorita that he gives me in a future episode coming up, to always put your earphones on to make sure it sounds good, not just it looks good, because it looked great, but it turns out it didn't sound great until I hit a button about 15 minutes in. So bear with us for about 15 minutes. The sound's not awful. You can still hear everything that both of us are saying, but at like the 14-minute mark or something like that in the interview, it kicks in, and from there on, the audio is crisp and perfect and beautiful, and Steve covers such a wide range of topics, and it was so much fun to sit down with him. So give me a break on the first few minutes of audio, and after that, sit back, relax, enjoy the soothing sounds of the voice of yours truly and Mr. Steve Hager.
Hey Joe, I like your show. I tell everybody that's my shit. And if you got a long ride and you like getting high, maybe go and take another hit. We gonna laugh out loud, that's what it's about. Nobody ain't safe no more. And Joe stands out even in a big crowd, cause the motherfucker's 6'4". Hey Joe, it's time to start the show. Up, up and away we go. Mic check and I like your flow. Everybody, here's Joe.
So I'm here in the backyard, back patio, back pool, hot pool, cold pool, sauna, the spa of
the Phoenix Nest.
The Phoenix Nest. That's what you're calling the place?
That's what it was. It was all from the day I moved in, this has been the Phoenix Nest.
That's Mr. Steve Hager. Steve, I've known you, I haven't seen you in a long time, but I've going back about 10 years now. When I worked with you, when you were the editor-in-chief of High Times Magazine. And
We had our whole movie. You had reached out to me after seeing Porn Foley Artist and brought me in to do some fun High Times. High Times The Office was the reality show that you had created.
Yeah, it was actually my third time around as editor-in-chief of High Times. Every time they fired me, the sales would just drop off a cliff. And when I came back the last time...
You're like what John Frusciante is to Red Hot Chili Peppers. Well, every time he leaves, it falls apart.
I would say Billy Martin. Yeah. That's what everybody said. I was the Billy Martin. But, you know, I came in there and I totally transformed the company. It was like... losing money, it was ready to go bankrupt. Within a year, I created the Cannabis Cup. I launched the Hemp Revolution. I totally transformed the marijuana movement, helped build the foundation of what made marijuana legal. So I always had so much static with the company. I never really had control of the covers or anything, and I was always being pushed
from the beginning, from your original?
From the day I walked in the door. Static.
But you started working there, was it 1988?
Yeah, and I instantly transformed it from a money-losing operation to the magazine success story of the 1980s and 90s.
I mean, everybody. I didn't even smoke pot until probably 2000, but even in the 80s and the 90s, not being a stoner, I knew it was all about High Times. That if I wanted to see cannabis and I wanted to know all about the culture... That's where I would get it. It was mentioned for all those decades, like nonstop, as the Bible.
We were the biggest selling title in Tower Records for a decade. So every other magazine in New York was reading High Times, trying to figure out what's going on, what's this guy doing. I had a three pronged approach. The first thing that I was pushing was let's get rid of hard drugs. Because it had been, the staff was heavily into powders. I was like, that sucks because, you know, like everybody else, you know, I experienced, you know, cocaine and the disco age and all that stuff. But at the same time, we figured out that cocaine wasn't really safe, you know, and that it caused...
You felt a responsibility to take it out.
Well, it caused depression. So it wasn't something you wanted to glorify. And of course... You know, I was totally not into heroin chic and all that stuff. You know, which
was there a time when those were just there's just pictures of that stuff in High Times?
They just promoted that culture.
Yeah.
I mean, heroin chic was all wrapped up in that whole Warhol era. Not that Warhol was promoting it, but the people around him, there were a lot of junkies.
Right.
So, and you know, it's like it's a trap. So I was like. You know,
so how do you arrive?
I wasn't even a big marijuana user. I mean, I would never turn it down.
Yeah.
If I was at a party, I'd be happy if somebody brought it up. But I wasn't buying it or, you know, using it on a regular basis or anything like that. I didn't have a problem with it. One thing I did realize, it was wholesome. You know, it didn't interfere with your sleep or your appetite. So... Compared to everything else that's out there, to me it was like the last thing you want to make illegal. So I was like, let's just focus on cannabis and natural things like mushrooms, and let's forget about white powders and all that bullshit. The other thing was, let's talk about politics, because, you know, we know the CIA killed Kennedy and the people that took over the government. Are those people? And
you wrote an article, if your Wikipedia page is true, in 1991 that got critical acclaim for being the JFK assassination article.
Well, it went out on the internet, and because the internet was basically new.
That's the baby steps of the internet.
So I mean, it was the first big. It was the only national magazine article ever published to reveal. Anything close to the real story, and just talk about all the CIA connections in the case. Because once you line up the dots, it's irrefutable. It's obvious. But
there's a new podcast, I don't know if you've heard about it, that's out right now. It's currently running in its first season, or, you know, the story, the RFK tapes. And I feel like that's going to be something like a Making the Murderer or Serial that's going to bring a lot of attention to this stuff, because it's just a way that, you know, of presenting where people are going, that guy might be innocent, you know? And but you're talking about...
These assassinations
this is 27 years ago that you wrote yours.
On what's really going on.
Right.
And that's just really the tip of the iceberg, because they're manipulating public opinion through a whole variety of propaganda campaigns. And they ridicule any idea that there's this concentrated power that's hidden by creating this huge alternative media like Alex Jones, which is just pumping total garbage. You know what I mean? It's like, I can tell you the real story of the Illuminati from start to finish.
Well, when I started working
with you... nothing like what's going on with this media shit.
When I started working with you at High Times, I came in and thought, oh, he's going to want to have me do the pot cooking show, and he's going to want to have me doing, you know, the pot morning show, and we're going to make a little pot network. And I get there, and I had just started to feel like it's time for me to get into the politics of everything and, like, fix, you know, try to help fix some things. And I sat down with you, we talked for a couple hours, and I left with a pile of books. I left with your book, I left with a book that you'd given me about the Bilderbergs. I'd given me a comic book about 9/11, a thing about the CIA, a Kennedy book. And for the next 2 weeks of my life, I took down the 7 books you gave me, and I came out from the other side like, oh, fuck. What? Like, that's a lot for me to take on right now. But I guess politics aren't the answer, because that's just a whole bunch of... it's a big dog and pony show.
Well, I felt like, you know, this kind of research I had been doing was entertainment to me. It's like, people do want to know this stuff.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit scary, which is fun, really. I mean, but the fact was, it was too scary.
Yeah.
The stuff I was doing was too scary, too threatening, too real. And,
But I feel like that changes so quickly. Like I was saying about the RFK podcast, it's now, you know, massive. It's like, now is the time where your information is still all out there. Your books are still out there. Your articles are still out there. Look up Steve Hager. Read it all. Do the book tour that I did, and, like, get really woke. You know, the woke isn't real woke.
Did you ever read my blog?
No.
It's called The Tin Whistle.
Okay.
Man,
I feel like you're always hiding just under some place. It's always happening just one step removed from
the
me.
The blog that I just wrote yesterday is called Captain Midnight's Secret Decoder Ring. And Captain Midnight was the biggest star of my parents' generation. He's a huge radio star. I mean, there's some films and TV and comic books everywhere. And kind of look like Flash. He's dressed in a red outfit, and he's got like a pilot's hat on. And Captain America was kind of like based on him, basically. You know what I mean? He's a later evolution, but Captain Midnight was secretly approached by the most powerful secret person running the government behind the scenes, and tasked with the assignment of creating a secret squadron who would fight enemy spies on American soil. And if you bought enough tins of Ovaltine and you sent the packaging, mailed it into, you know, the radio show in Chicago, they send you an ID card to be a member of the Secret Squadron. And they would also send you Secret Decoder, so that the messages that each show delivered at the end to the squadron could be decrypted and translated. And those kids who fervently wanted to fight whatever Captain was fighting that week, religiously would spin those dials and figure it out and do the decryption. But then when they figured out, the message was always, buy more tins of Ovaltine. The whole magic show kind of collapsed.
Yeah. It's incredible.
But, you know, the whole point of me going into that, you know, was about a month and a half, 2 months before the Japanese actually attacked Pearl Harbor. The Captain Midnight Show had made the Japanese the enemy and had revealed the secret plot to bomb Pearl Harbor.
That's incredible.
So, what's interesting about that whole thing to me is that in 1917, President Wilson created the Creel Committee of Public Information, whose was just a straight-up propaganda operation to bring America into the European War. Because we were isolationists. We didn't want to send our boys to go die.
Right.
You know what I mean? America was had no designs on any invasions or armies or any of that shit. So it took months of intense psychological prepping to get the United States into World War I.
Of the population? Or of...
They just had extensive propaganda campaigns, you know, and this guy, Edward Bernays, who was the nephew of Sigmund Freud, he was like their chief, what you'd call, psychological operations director, thinking up things that would
help
demonize the scapegoats and the enemies and, you know, inflame the bloodlust. Let's get the, you know what I mean? Let's join the, you know, they whip people up and they send you off to battle and then... When you come back with post-traumatic stress disorder, they just leave you in the gutter. Yeah. That's the way it always is. But people just don't realize, you don't get swept up in that shit because they ain't going to look at you. They ain't going to take care of you. When this war's over, they're going to forget about you. But what I really see now with that Captain Midnight thing is they were prepping. They were softening us up for this big war with Japan. And we know they had plenty of advanced knowledge. It wasn't just the Captain Midnight show. There was a lot of advanced knowledge that Pearl Harbor was going to happen. So we didn't really need to lose as many people or as many boats. We could have just walloped them on arrival. You know what I mean?
But if we don't, then...
But if we wallop them on arrival...
We got no reason to.
We don't go to war on two fronts.
Yeah.
We go, hey, we're cool.
Yeah.
See what I mean? So the Illuminati is what, whatever name you want to put on it, that's what's manufacturing these wars for profit. And they string the wars out till they've sold enough gunpowder and then they end the war.
Yeah. So there's so much information always to take on all this stuff. It's like every little wormhole you can go down for years, the JFK thing. Yeah. So, plain and simple, who killed John F. Kennedy?
The thing about when I was editor of High Times for like 20 years is I got to actually investigate all this stuff and go to the primary sources. And what I discovered after years and years was that the primary sources that were speaking to me were all spooks. They were feeding me bad information. They would incite me with a little bit of real stuff, and then they'd take me into a rabbit hole with that real stuff, and it would be bullshit at the end of the trail. So it took me a long time, and we could see the shadows on the wall that the CIA was doing it, but you couldn't really pinpoint exactly how they did it. But I'm relatively certain that JFK closed down JM Wave, which was the largest CIA base outside of Langley. Thousands of employees, mostly Cuban mercenaries, who had come over and escaped from Cuba and were now being trained as paramilitaries to invade Cuba. JFK made a secret deal after the Cuban Missile Crisis not to invade Cuba, to remove American missiles from Turkey. That Pentagon was very mad about those missiles being taken out of Turkey. And he basically was trying to broker detente with Cuba and the Soviet Union. And the Pentagon was really pissed off about that. And when he fired Alan Dulles, who's the cousin by marriage of his primary political opponent, who was actually David Rockefeller, who's running the oil companies, mm-hmm. Alan Dulles and his brother, who came up with IG Farben, which is the company that funded and put Hitler in power, was built by Alan Dulles' brother, who was Secretary of State
and was also the head of the most powerful law firm in America, Sullivan and Cromwell. So you got to, you know, you got to mention these brothers. One is the head of the CIA. The other's former Secretary of State running the most powerful law firm in America for all the biggest corporations. Mm-hmm. The concentration of power between these two cousins of Rockefeller is so intense that what probably happened is that Dulles had put his buddy in charge of counterintelligence, James Jesus Angleton. And Angleton was played by Soviet spooks. And a false mole put Angleton on a hunt for a high-placed mole in the United States government. It seems pretty obvious to me that Angleton fingered JFK as that mole. And completely legally, the national security system eliminated the threat by any means necessary and covered it up. And no laws were broken.
That's, I mean, incredible. And I was with you for so much. And then at the end, it's like he's the president of the United States, essentially below the Rockefellers in government.
Well, I'm saying if you're perceived as a threat to the national security, the CIA and the Justice Department and the National Security Council can conspire to have you neutralized by any means necessary to save the country, and you will be considered a patriot. So the people participating at the highest level, many of them thought they were saving the country because they seriously believed this report that JFK was a Soviet mole. But John Roselli was one of the shooters, apparently, because he was working.
Who's John Roselli?
Valentine's Day Massacre.
Okay.
He was the gunman for the Giancana outfit out of Chicago, and they put him in charge of L.A. and Las Vegas. He was, you know, he was one of the most charismatic, handsome hitmen in the history of the Sicilian Brotherhood of Honor. Which is fallen. As a result of Joe Bonanno Sr. writing his autobiography and detailing the entire structure of the five families. And
right.
Allowing Giuliani the blueprint that he needed to totally dismantle the operation. So
yeah, and there's so many tunnels, so many exits I can take on the.
But
highway,
these guys, but, the Sicilian men of honor and the CIA, are just two sides of the same coin. That's right. What you need to understand.
So, Lee Harvey Oswald, is he shooting? Is he hitting the president with bullets?
No, he's in the lunchroom getting a Coke out of the machine.
I mean, yeah, it's so...
Immediately after the shooting, he's whisked away in a car by David Morales. And he's dropped...
Oswald is?
Yeah, he's dropped off at his house, and he's told to pick up his revolver, although I don't think he knows the firing pin doesn't work. And he's told to go to this movie theater in the neighborhood. He's just moved into this rooming house in Oak Cliff, which is where the CIA has, like, the operations, a safe house, and a bunch of Cubans. So he's moved very quickly out of the area to the movie theater. I think he was supposed to be killed in the movie theater, because he did pull out a gun in the movie theater and brandish it. And
that was there.
There's three policemen there.
Yep.
I think Tippett was supposed to be there and just plug him in the heart. You know what I mean? It's like you always know kind of when it's like an assassination, because it's never one bullet. It's typically two in rapid succession. You know what I mean? That's like a trained shooter. They always tell them, you fire twice. You know what I mean? In case something went wrong with the first one or whatever. It's always two in rapid succession. So I don't know how I came up with that tangent. But, you know.
So the CIA and the mob together killed John F. Kennedy.
Yeah.
And then the RFK.
With the help of the oil companies.
Yeah. Right. And everybody else who had power and anybody who had X amount of money was in on the.
Very few people knew anything. Most people were given a cover story. Even mm-hmm. at the highest levels, you'd be given some cover story. But even at the highest, highest, highest level, you were told he was a Soviet mole. So, you know.
Right. Oh, man. So you write all that in when you're at High Times in 91?
Yeah.
And, of course, that goes, you know, viral for the time.
Yeah, and the funny thing was, up until that point, I had basically been like the golden boy of High Times. I was actually in on some of the inside
stuff. Where were you before High Times?
Yeah, I was the first journalist to write about hip hop.
I know that, and I was gonna ask you about that. I didn't want to. So you were that's like prior to taking over at High Times. You're yeah. a writer in New York.
I wrote about the hip hop, and I got a movie deal off that with Orion.
Is the phrase that you're the first person to write hip hop in a major publication?
Yeah, yeah, I coined that term, but yeah. You know the kids
now it's a genre.
The kids were using the term,
right?
But it didn't have a universal flavor yet.
Right.
The industry called it rap music at the time.
The industry being?
The music industry.
Yeah.
And they were very resistant to rap music. They didn't like it. It was considered, prison shit, you know, basically.
And this is in the Bronx in the late 70s, early
80s? Yeah, 77.
And that's the beginning of hip hop. That's the, like, you can trace it back to the formation, like, yeah. you know.
What happened was I was interested in the art world. I had come to New York with an artist, a girlfriend I was in love with, and she ditched me. She used me to get her to New York. And once she was here.
She went and did the art thing. She went and did the New York art thing.
She went her own way.
Yeah.
Very quickly. And it was like. The thing was,
that was her trip, man.
I wonder, did I become an art reporter to try and win her back in some way? I don't know.
Probably to just be in the periphery of the scene. And,
she'd take credit because yeah. Through a weird happenstance, I was watching the art scene, but then I got a job at Leo Scholl's Show Business Newspaper. For $100 a week. And the guy who gave me the job was a University of Illinois graduate like me, recent graduate. And he introduced me to another recent Illinois graduate called, and this is, I went on to run High Times. One of them went on to be the first news director of MTV, and the other became the head of records, considered the greatest label, the most intelligent anyway.
Yeah.
The most, you know, the one with the most integrity. You know what I mean? So the three of us bonded and we formed a secret society because throughout my entire life, I've been forming these secret societies.
The squadron. You formed the squadron.
So
it was called the
Lenny Tristano Appreciation Society.
And who's Lenny Tristano?
The only white guy that went to the top of the jazz world.
Okay.
So, you know. Toe to toe with Miles,
yeah,
and Ornette and the rest of them. So, actually, I didn't know who he was either, and until they told me, and I didn't know jack shit about music. Really, I had grown up in the '60s and was into like acid rock, but I had lost interest in music. They brought me to CB's. They told me what was going on. They introduced me to hip hop. You know what I mean? So,
and what's it like in being a white Midwestern kid in the late 70s going into the Bronx and going into Harlem?
Scary. It was scary, but
what, you're just getting on the train with a notebook and I'd, going to hang out?
I'd go to the shows really early while I was still light out. And I'd go home. I'd go home with escorts to get me to the subway. So I didn't feel safe at night. I felt perfectly safe during the day. So
did you feel safe at, like, I mean, are you going to...
But I, no, like, I want to tell you the story how I got involved to write about hip-hop.
Okay.
So I'm covering the art scene, and there's this art show called New York New Wave. And it's in Long Island City. And it's the kind of show that invited a lot of new artists in. And I go there, and there's a lot of graffiti, photographs and actual work, and the first paintings I'd ever seen by Jean-Michel Basquiat. And I was looking at a one of the pictures, photographs of the subway cars all stretched out, and it was by Futura 2000, and it was like a car that was splintered in the center like it had been blown up in a nuclear explosion. And the title of the card written on it was Break. And my roommate had just given me a record called The Breaks by Curtis Blow. It had just been released as a promo to Record World, where he was working at the time. I had just gotten that record that day, and I was staring at that painting, and I said, this graffiti is connected to this rap music, which means there's some kind of cultural revolution going on that nobody's writing about. Maybe I should write about this. And I went and interviewed Futura 2000. From there, I went and interviewed Fab Five Freddy, interviewed Afrika Bambaataa, interviewed Kool Herc, interviewed Grandmaster Flash, interviewed Melly Mel. See, I just started working my way.
Yeah.
And over a period of 6 months, I collected the story of how it all happened from the real players and started figuring out who's lying, who's... Because everybody, every joker was trying to play it like, oh, I started it.
Right.
It wasn't that easy to penetrate.
Yeah. It, like a cultural movement doesn't start
It was just taken off.
Yeah.
But the thing that I learned from that was that any 50 people can do it. Any 50 people can create a cultural revolution. If you can unify it, if you can get a new style going with your group, a Congo Square created blues, jazz, and rock and roll. I swear to you, the origins of Congo Square look exactly like the origins of hip-hop in the parks, in the weekends, in the South Bronx. It's no more than 50 people. There's a circle. People go inside the center of the circle and go off. It's the same.
And there's a DJ.
And there's a lot of conga drums. DJ's not important.
Yeah.
The conga drum is what is, you know what I mean? So that's what I believe, that moment at Congo Square is what created the counterculture. And it was a merger of all cultures because everybody was welcome. They were trying to sell shit too, like a dead, you know, shakedown street.
Right.
It was Slaves Day Off, Sunday. And some of them were making shit and selling it, and some of them were performing. And the best drummers and musicians were improvising, and the dancers were improvising. And it was a melding of African, European, and Native American sensibilities. And when you merge all cultures like that, you create what's known as hybrid vigor. This is our culture. It's a merger of all cultures. And anybody that accepts that and get 50 people from a different variety of backgrounds together and start, you know, improving creative energy, that's how it's done. It's not done by old men sitting in big offices making $1 million a year.
They're just capitalizing on it.
Yeah, it's done by junior high school kids. That's where it starts. That's where cultural revolution starts, with junior high school kids. 15 is the age when you can create your own culture. After that, it's probably too late. Because you're going to get indoctrinated.
Yeah. So you follow a girl to the art scene, to the graffiti scene, to the hip-hop, and then...
Yeah, and I meet these guys who are really into music, and they kind of like... helped transform me from Midwestern hick to cool New York dude, you know, kind of like, oh.
You did go to Woodstock, right?
All I actually did was revert to what I looked like in 1969.
Right.
I realized, because it was the revival of the 60s. So I started a garage rock band. I got out my old 60s clothes. They were suddenly so fashionable. You know what I mean? So, you know, it kind of like, after, you know, actually, you know, I didn't intend to go to college, actually. I escaped to Vietnam and was going to, I guess, live in Europe for the rest of my life. But I...
You escaped to Europe.
Well, I got a one-way ticket to Stockholm in 1970 and had arrived with no money and just bullshitted my way into the country. And I could have stayed, and I had a beautiful Swedish girlfriend very quickly. And... I got a job as an extra, a film extra, in a film called Joe Hill. And the thing was, if I would have surrendered my American citizenship and given up my passport, they would have let me stay. And after a few months, if I'd been a good boy, I might have been able to get a Swedish passport. But after, you know, being there and... the dead of winter when the sun pops up in the south for 10 minutes and then goes back down. I don't like the cold.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't see myself in this environment for the rest of my life. And so
that's beyond cold. That's like so the next level six, cold.
6 months into it, I just like got thrown out of the country because I did not qualify for political asylum. And I came back and flunked my, I did everything to try and get out of that draft physical. And
what's the flunk procedure?
So funny. First you refuse. They give you a list of about 100 different organizations tied to some form of socialism and ask you if you've ever been a member of any of these or if you have any sympathy with this shit, right? And
you just circle the whole bunch and go.
Well, I didn't, but I was like, yeah, I'm in sympathy with this. I was like, I'm not going to sign this. I'm in sympathy or whatever. And I was like, and immediately, this is right at the beginning. You know, you have to take an IQ test that takes about 10 minutes. And you can see guys that have been there 5 times trying to pass this thing. I mean,
they want in.
Yeah, but yeah. They're too dumb.
Yeah.
Because the test is a joke.
Right.
All right. So it's like, you could flunk that test, but they're going to know. You know, if your IQ is over 80, they're going to know.
Right.
So, you know, the only thing you can do right away is you can basically say, I have sympathy with the enemy. You know what I mean? So then they go, look, I'm still going to get drafted. What's going to happen is, you're going to get flagged, and you're going to get the shit end of the stick the whole time you're in. So that's, you know, that's what they were telling me.
Yeah.
So, and then there's the physical. And by the way, I had stayed up for 3 days, and I hadn't eaten a solid meal in a week, and I was skin and bones all the time. But now, this time I had been told that if I was below a certain weight, they wouldn't take me.
So what'd you come in at?
I don't know what I came in. Maybe 122 or something. But the thing was, they didn't care about my weight. This was later in the war to the point where he can walk. We're taking him.
Yeah.
Okay. So then I realized the weight didn't work. The sympathy with the enemy didn't work. There was only one thing possible left. And that was a request to talk to the psychologist. I went in that room. And by the way, the master sergeant that had been running the show had been assigned to keep an eye on me because
he knew you were trying to get out.
Well, these kids, these 100 kids that were there, bussed up there with me from my town.
Where is this?
Champaign, Illinois. But the induction center was in Chicago. We were in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going straight to boot camp. There was no stop, collect, nothing. We were going straight to boot camp. So that Master Sergeant was getting me on that bus to boot camp, and he had made it kind of like his...
he was on the stretch run.
His mission for the day
yeah,
was to make sure I didn't slip out. Okay, so he's waiting right outside the psychiatrist's door, and I go in and talk to the psychiatrist. And I'm like, this isn't going to work. I was like, well, what makes you say that? And I said, well, my parents tried to put me into college, to a religious Lutheran college, the one they'd graduated from. And I went up there and was put into a dormitory with a lot of normal people. And I became kind of like, you know, the most undesirable person in the dorm because of who I am. I couldn't have been more vague, but I was telling the truth. And I started to cry. I think I was crying because I was so scared of boot camp. And I knew this was my last, you know, refuge.
Yeah, Hail Mary.
It's my Hail Mary, and if I squirt a few tears, it isn't going to hurt.
Yeah, yep.
And he didn't go any deeper. And I could tell this guy's heart wasn't into this war. And he wrote me a psychological deferment on the spot. And I'll never forget the look on that Master Sergeant when I walked out of that room with a big beaming smile. 4F, baby. Damn, he was pissed. He was so pissed.
And that's you never stop screwing the man.
Well, I mean, my brother did conscientious objector and did 2 years in a Chicago hospital. And he was, right then, he was at the end of his first year. And so he was there. So yeah. My first thing was to go see him. He was pissed.
Yeah.
In fact, that experience being a hospital worker kind of woke him up, because he was like, you won't believe what goes on in hospitals.
Yeah.
Don't go to a hospital, man.
Get out. I'll meet you outside.
Just don't go there. The shit that goes on in there is it's crazy, man.
That's incredible. So... So when you get out, when you don't have to go, you're in Chicago, you're in Urbana. That's where you went to school.
Yeah,
Champaign.
Well, yeah, my dad was a professor there.
Yeah, and then you follow a woman in New York.
Well, I went.
You come with her.
I went back to college after that, and I got a degree in theater and then a master's degree in journalism. And
you came to New York to write.
I just came to New York because I was following I would have gone wherever this girl said, we're going to Madison. We're going to California.
Right.
It didn't matter to me. You know what I mean? So, you know, she had a sister who lived here in New York, and her sister's boyfriend ran a recording studio in Soho. And they were really high-powered, connected people. I remember the first days walking around, seeing them and the people around them. These people were fucking dressed to the nines. I mean, full-length camel coats. And you know what I mean? I was just like, they all had like $400 hats on and shit.
Right.
You know what I mean?
The fashion
and it's
crowd.
Like, here I am, you know, can you imagine? I'm wearing like hiking boots and a down jacket, and I think, you know, a ski jacket or something, like really ridiculous. And, you know what I mean? It's like, I didn't know, you know?
Yeah. So we talked about you
but,
coming.
But I started trying to write articles. Soho Weekly News, Show Business Newspaper, whoever would take a writing job.
And... So after that, how do you go from having the how do you get into just straight into High Times from there?
I had started a weekly newspaper after the Soho Weekly News folded, because I was one of their contributors, and it was called New York Beat. It came out every week, and three of us produced the paper. Me, another editor, and an art director. I don't think, you know, you can't imagine the level of work of putting out a weekly newspaper in downtown New York. It had distribution to all the newsstands. And
I mean,
with three people.
Yeah. I was going to say, I know the work that went into putting out our college newspaper with 85 people, and that barely got to the cafeteria on time.
This is before computers.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have a typesetter that's got a set. I mean, he's setting it on a computer.
Yeah.
But we're not feeding him anything. We're typing.
Right.
You know what I mean? So and it was pretty good. It was pretty good. New York.
How many issues did that comes out?
I think we lasted 3 months, maybe.
Okay.
And it should have gone on, but the guy who was funding it, he pulled the button. He pulled the rug. He was just a community newspaper guy. He didn't understand the potential of what we had going or anything like that. And plus, you know, the editor I was working with, he wasn't working as hard as me, but he got the job at High Times during that period. He applied for High Times. And I was doing Beat Street. So I went from, you know, I went into a movie. He went into High Times. He immediately tried to get me involved in High Times. I went over to High Times. I checked out what they were doing. I put together an issue for him with ZZ Top on the cover, and I commissioned an article from a guy I knew to write about ZZ Top. I said, this is what you should be doing. Music. And hippie music. So that was the biggest selling issue of the year. But I only did that issue that year. I think it was 85 maybe. And so then they were always calling me up and saying, you know, I want you to come back, you know, be executive editor, blah, blah, blah. So like, I wasn't that into working at a drug magazine, but, you know, after Beat Street kicked me out of my own movie, I didn't have anything else to do. So I went to High Times. And
they pay okay in those days?
I think I get $20,000. I made more money as a reporter for the Daily News. But the thing was, the first thing I did was plan a special indoor grow issue. And start telling people, don't buy pot on the street. Grow your own. And then I started telling them, pretty soon I found out, oh, you can get seeds from Holland. Order the seeds from Holland and grow your own. That's how everything changed.
Yeah.
Is I was, you know, telling people, grow your own, and here's where to get the seeds. And by the way, here's the best equipment. Oh, and I was the first guy to write about Sia Green. Here's the technique where you can make pounds in a few months. And not have big plants, just have little popsicle sticks full of buds. So I, you know, that was me. I did all that,
and that it leads right into you starting the Cannabis Cup.
Yeah, exactly. Because I was like, hey, it's legal over there. We can have like a show, like an award show, like you do for any plant or any dog or any horse, right. Or any, you know what I mean? Or any movie
person.
Or, yeah, I mean, yeah. Come on, you know, it's a no brainer, you know? So, you know, almost instantly the Cannabis Cup had more going for it than High Times. It was when Wikipedia came around, the Cannabis Cup had way more views on Wikipedia than High Times. People cared way more about the Cannabis Cup.
Well, I remember that's, like I said, I didn't even start smoking pot until I was in college, and that's when you first hit it, like, I first hit it as an adult, and I'm like, wow, okay, I'm into, like, I'm into the world. That's when I really come across High Times for the first time, where I'm buying it and reading it, because I need to know, how do I grow it? How do I get it? How do I, whatever, why am I doing, you know, obviously now it's a whole different world, but why am I dealing with, like, sketchy black market people when, like, I grew up in Westchester. I know where there's land. I know how plants work. My dad had a garden. Like, what are we doing here? And that's, you know, what takes you to High Time. That's what takes you to things like the Cannabis Cup. What is the best? What is, like,
yeah, we
what does it look
it
like?
Quick.
What does it look like, you know?
All these strains are out today. We're all discovered. you know, people think, oh, some genius went into a lab and developed this shit. No, no, no. These people all ordered seeds from Amsterdam. Some of the seeds were grown overseas. Some of them were grown here and just mailed out of the States. But the thing was, this proliferation of hybrid seeds, F1 hybrids, where you take different genes from wide varieties and you get the seed that'll give you one generation that's a mix, and then after that it goes bonkers, develops super strains, one in a thousand, one in a million. But who gets the magic beans? That's the real story of Jack the Beanstalk, see? Out of all those thousands of people that order seeds, one guy got Diesel. One guy got Kush. One guy got Girl Scout cookies. See what I mean? It's it was no genius. It was happenstance.
Right.
So.
But then it's cultivating that and keeping it. And
yeah.
And.
I mean, industry could do this if it was legal because they could grow out thousands and thousands of plants, F1 right. hybrids, and they could say, oh, there's the super plant. But in this case, it was the super plant was hidden amongst all these other deliveries. And only if you were smart enough, a lot of people try to grow pot and seeds all died, whatever. They never even got a foot-high plant. That might have been a super seed. You just don't know.
Right.
So to me, the story of Jack and the Beanstalk is really the story of getting the magic bean. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Who got that Diesel? You know what I mean? So we know it came out of Colorado. So
you've traced it back to Colorado.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a bag of weed sold at a Dead Show in Indiana. And it was bought by a guy in Boston. And it had like 4 seeds, and the Diesel, the New York Diesel, all that stuff comes out of that. So
that's amazing. So then the cannabis cup, like you said, takes on a life of its own. That's where everybody knows in Amsterdam every year everybody's gonna get together. There's gonna be an expo.
Yeah, the new technology appears there first. Yeah. It's like the car show.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I mean, I've been with you. I meet you about, I want to say it was like 6 or 7 months out from, was that the 20th Cannabis Cup that we did?
I think it was. And because it was the 20th Cannabis Cup and because Borat had just come out.
Yeah.
My plan was to create a.
But you, before we even get there, over those 20 years, it becomes the biggest, like, yeah. So this is everybody. People are coming from all over the world to go to this thing.
Yeah.
Your editors are getting in a room and smoking it all. And I remember the submission process.
Well, I had almost instantly, you know, decided to make it a spiritualized event. So we created a secret temple where it had rules. We didn't want alcohol in it. We had glass jars. Before this, nobody used glass jars. Now everybody uses glass jars.
Right.
But we were I started the glass jar thing where we put codes on the jar and we would just have shelves. And everything started out at the bottom. And as people
How
like,
many entries is the first Cannabis Cup getting?
4. But
so only one person
the process,
didn't get a medal.
The process, the temple, the way the jars, that took years to develop. But if people liked the strain, they would move the jar up. So the good strains just moved up to the top shelf. And eventually one would be up there at the top. It happened organically over a week. So there was no need for writing down things. I'm so annoyed when people hand you this like ballot. It's got 15 things on it. And you're supposed to rate from 1 to 10, all those things. And then they put all those numbers into a computer. Dude, if I gave you 10 bags of weed,
yeah,
I came back in 3 days, I would just check to see which weed you were smoking.
Yeah.
It ain't that complicated.
But it's
it became big.
But they
business.
Try to make it scientific, right. You know what I mean?
They it it's became a big bullshit. Business that for High Times to for people to come over and get the passes and go to the event and go to the expo and see all the corporate now weed wares. And so that now there has to be at least the parade of we're doing this in a very specific way. You can't buy and sell. But what I learned in coming there after I went through your book, you know, did my book reports and had my mind blown is you started telling me about the Cannabis Cup and how it is. It's just like anything else. It's just a PR thing now. And in the big the guys who have money to give the most lighters away and smoke the most people up are the ones that everybody's favorite. And you wanted to sort of show that. You wanted to sort of expose your own event.
Well, no, we were upfront that it was the way to win the Cannabis Cup was to spend a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, buy a huge booth, give away a lot of free shit.
Right.
Okay, so that makes the people happy. You know, even if you have like dirt weed, if you're giving away pounds of it, you're getting votes.
Right.
So, but I created a separate blind seed company cup that only experts were involved in, and they were voting blind. They weren't going to coffee shops.
Right.
And so we had our commercial.
Right. You sort of made the Cannabis Cup and then reappropriated it to a smaller one and let everybody have the original, you know, show.
Yeah, well, I mean, we wanted to let the companies go whole hog, and at the same time, we wanted to have a separate competition where the seed companies who were actually selling the seeds were a little bit more scrutinized, and they couldn't buy their way into that one. So, you know, you could buy the Cannabis Cup, but you couldn't buy the seed company cup.
And when I started working with you, the idea that you sort of the homework you had given me, part of it included like a High Times like paperback like compilation or something like that, and it had Tom Forsad.
Yeah.
His story in there, and he told me read up on this, read that.
Well, yeah, because we were kind of like us trying to like make you like a new emanation of Tom in a way, sort of, you know,
yeah.
Like.
And so I played,
but not this, a smuggler, a grower.
A grower,
yeah.
And I played this sort of small New York grower with some
Had the best weed.
Who had
magic beans?
Yeah,
that was the idea.
Who had the Ookie Kabuki? Yeah. He had the best of the best. He had the Ookie Kabuki, but then
by happenstance,
yeah, and yeah, because he was a complete and utter fool and bipolar and had psychotic episodes. So he didn't do it on purpose. But then you inserted this character into the Cannabis Cup. You're like, go and do a Borat thing. Never stop being this guy. You got the Ookie Kabuki, your Big Apple seeds.
Well, I went to the best weed broker in Amsterdam when we arrived, and I bought the best weed in Amsterdam, which was, there was only a little bit of it. And I bought it out. And then I entered it. I gave it to you, and you entered it.
Yeah.
I gave you $1,000 to enter it.
Well, you gave me, I remember you gave me that bag. You said, this has been on the shelf for 6 months. This is the best thing here. You said, I want you to take it. I want you to smoke everybody up with it. But then I'm going to give you this bag of dirt weed, and you're going to submit that. So it won't win. And then you're like,
really? We separated?
Yeah. And then you said, I want you to smoke up everybody so they actually think you have the best weed.
But we had you on stage with Robert Connell Clark.
Yep.
And he was testing Ookie Kabuki.
Yep. Yeah.
Against other strains.
Against DNA seeds.
And didn't he pick it?
Yeah, he did. And they were very upset. We didn't know it was going to be a bowl thing.
The High Times staff was completely freaked out during this whole thing because...
So that's what I wanted to say was, this is your event. This is your the leader of the thing. And I'm like, I'm going to Amsterdam for 10 days and I'm just going to be able to smoke people up. And I just got to pretend I'm in I grow weed and it's all expense paid and this is perfect. It was one of the most stressful 10 days
because
of my life.
Time staff was so opposed to this whole
because
thing.
They just didn't. Every time I walked in,
they saw no humor in this.
Yeah. And they hated it.
Yeah, like I explained the whole thing earlier. I don't think you got it on tape, but, you know, when I came back the third time to be editor, Nobody wanted me there. And
this is the third time when this happened. What makes you leave the first two times? Just
the first time, I'm just fed up. I'm like, hey, look, either give me real power and authority, or I just want to do video and work on my events. I had like five events, and I mean, I was publishing books that were winning the Firecracker Award for kind of cultural journalism. I was putting out my videos. I had events that I was creating every year, new ones every year. They were all great events, all successful. And I was running the magazine. It was hugely successful. And I was like, oh, and I'm getting static with this kind of production.
Yeah.
So I'm like, hey, you know, I'm doing five jobs. So, you know, if you don't want me running the magazine, because they were all set up, the magazine's suffering because you're doing these other things. I'm like, fine, put somebody in charge of the magazine. See if you can do better. And of course, they could not even approach what I was doing in the magazine. So they would, you know, after a few months of miserable sales.
So this is your Billy. This
back.
Is your Billy Martin. Steinbrenner fires you. Hired
you. Come
you,
back.
Fires,
yeah,
fires,
yeah,
fires
yeah. Come on back. So, but then the whole bullshit thing would start up again. You know what I mean? So, I mean, the first time I was like, I'm out of here. I just want to shoot video and work on my events. And they were like, fine. They were happy. You know, we'll show you. But they couldn't show me. Because they didn't know what they were doing. So, you know, the second time it was just a total fucking secret society hatchet job where I was being led into a rabbit hole and it blew up on them and it was exposed, you know. So poor Buffalo Mailer, Norman Mailer's son was involved. Had no idea what kind of bullshit they dragged him into, but he was secretly coming in to be installed as my executive editor so he could ferret out all the stuff, and then I was going to be dumped. And then, you know, the whole thing was exposed before it could even start. Like the day he arrived, that it was all a scam and that his buddy Richard Stratton was going to come in and be editor. So then, you know, it's like, it's kind of, you know, it's like, okay, you know, I did my best. I knew they were coming to get me.
Right.
That's why I started going after the Illuminati and everything. Because it was like, you know, I kind of knew. It's like, after I exposed the CIA, it was like, everything changed. Like, that CIA story.
He knows too much.
That CIA story, I should have gotten awards.
Right.
I should have been recognized. Instead, I was like 86th everywhere. You know what I mean? So then I realized, oh, you can't do that. It's like, you know, I have a friend, you know, who's a very successful actor, one of the most successful black actors. And it was like, Steve, I wish you had come to me and told me you were going to write that story about the CIA, because I would have told you not to do that.
Yeah. But then they bring you back again.
Only because they were pissed off at the staff, and the best way they could punish them was to bring me back, because they all didn't.
So the staff that was there, like when you came back, they already were not interested. You were already editing them on.
Every single editor thought they were going to be made editor in chief.
Right.
None of them wanted me. You know, I had a good staff at one time. They had all either left or betrayed me. So anybody that liked me early on was 86th. You know, I got so isolated. I can only describe it like, imagine you are whatever that guy is, Captain Queeg or whatever. You're on the destroyer. Your whole staff hates you. Everything you do is turned into something bad. Suddenly, you start rolling metal balls. You know what I mean? It's like, it's the pressure from the people around you that's causing this. And it's like, the funny thing was, if Guy had been a little more sophisticated and understood what's happening, and had really taken my, like, perspective, and we had just pursued the Borat movie and fucked them, we could have made it. Could have made a splash.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But everybody was so blindsided by all the hatred and static against me. Nobody was expecting
it. Well, I remember just coming to the office to see you. It was like you had totally isolated yourself in this office, and I walking down the hall to just eyeball. It was like dead man walking. Like people just that you could feel the bad energy.
Yeah.
Oh, they're going to see Steve. Oh, that's Steve's trip. Like right. That's and everybody there was just always. And I remember the 10 days in Amsterdam, while still incredibly fun and an experience I wouldn't trade for anything, was like just a whole organization of people that were like, nah, fuck these guys. And I thought I loved where you were at. I'm like, yeah, why not? Let's have fun. It's an experience. It's an event. It's a expo. Like, let's all have a.
Yeah. My whole thing was let's
make a movie.
You know, we can do Borat, but we can do a better Borat.
Yeah.
So I knew you had the talent, and but everybody there was so threatened that I would find somebody and we would create a show. It would be successful. Then how the fuck are they going to get rid of me? You know what I mean? It's like,
then they're stuck with you. So how long after that did was the next time your final removal?
Well, what happened was. After I tried to do the Borat movie, I was removed as editor, but I was left with the job. It just like savagely reduced my salary and shit. And I told them I just want to go home. I'll work from home. And they just didn't want anything from me. So they would pay me my salary just for writing a column. In fact, they were kind of orders. I would write stuff and nothing would be published. I write books on Tom Prasad, nothing would be published. It was kind of like, he's allowed 500 words in every magazine. And that is all. Okay. So I went from the biggest producer and, you know, producing quality work on every platform, creating my own platforms, to 500 words in the magazine. And then one day, after about couple of years of that, they killed the column. And it just so happened that same week, I'd been working on a movie deal with Orion for 2 years. Now we had a finished script, and the Temple Dragons and my candles, everything was in the movie. It was called High Times Cannabis Cup. Only High Times had a clause in the contract. They had to give script approval. When they saw the script and they saw that, oh, Hager's shit is in here, it was like, take all that shit out or you can't do the movie. And the producers came to me and they said, what the fuck is this? And I can only equate this to...
But like, so, the cannabis, I mean, that's your event.
I can only equate this to somebody hands you the script to the Wizard of Oz and the head of the studio says, take out the witches.
Yeah.
Because, see, that spirituality, that magic I was putting into the cannabis cup, that improvisational energy that merged all cultures and all that stuff, that was the cannabis cup. That was what excited people. That was what gave it its soul. And it doesn't have that soul anymore. But the thing was, they couldn't, I was just clinging. Even though I was completely destroyed, I had, you know, huge mountains of debt. I was clinging to this hope that someday the things I had done with the cannabis cup would be shown. And this movie was my attempt to do that. You know what I mean? And when they killed that, I lost it. And I didn't want anything to do with High Times after that. I just wanted out.
And what happens to all of your video footage and all your archives and all your...
Well, what was interesting was, at the time, I owned 10% of the stock. And I was being abused as a minority shareholder. I was a senior citizen. And I began writing to the owners, the various owners who owned stock, and outlining what the problems were, what needed to be done, and the horrible things that had been done to me. And I was asking for $150 a week raise, $200 a month raise, because my kid needed braces. And it escalated. It's like, I thought I could get the raise. I was crushed by all this debt and all that's going on. And, you know, I went from a big, huge salary to very little salary. And I wasn't prepared for that. It takes you years to recalibrate that shit. I had to remortgage my house. It was like I went so deep. You know, it's like, and I just was trying to keep my head above water. And then my kid needs braces. And they're telling me it's probably going to cost $5,000 over 5 years. And you know, he still has the braces on.
Yeah.
This is 6.5 years later. So it's $250 a month. And it's just like, the whole thing just broke me. They had crushed me. They had killed every project. They killed several projects, not just the Borat movie, not just the Orion Pictures movie. There were lots of other projects.
Right. Everywhere you turned.
Anytime I got traction, I got something off the ground, it was like at the last minute, the 11th hour, suddenly they would swoop in and just, nope. And, you know, later on, I realized this was all a psychological campaign. They were gaslighting me, and they were, you know, torturing me. So I'd break. And I did break. So, but the funny thing was, you know, by some fucking miracle, I got myself out of debt. But then I made a lot of money in Bitcoin.
You're the guy. What told you to get into Bitcoin when you did?
I was just desperate. You know, I tried to get a fair price off my shares. I had buyers. I was going to collect $2 million. And I got so happy. And I took my kids out to the most expensive restaurant in New York. I was like, we're millionaires. We're going to Germany. And then, you know what I mean? It was like, I've been like so pressed down, you know. But I was just exploding with joy. I've got buyers, $250,000 each. And they're written statements saying, yes, I will buy the share and blah, blah, blah. And then at the 11th hour, they had an emergency meeting and they rewrote the articles of incorporation and they made it impossible for me to move my shares. And they wanted me to sell out for like, you know, nickels on the dollar. And they said, we'll give you rights to exploit your video. So I was like, okay, I'll take that deal. Because otherwise I have no rights.
Right.
So I took the deal and then they seized all the video. And then after that happened, I moved all my High Times archives, anything I had, out of my apartment and I put it in storage. And for 5 years, I could not think about High Times.
And what year was that when you finally left?
Like
5 years ago?
No, it's more like six years ago now.
Yeah.
But the thing was, they had given me a payout over the time. They were paying me every quarter. So four times a year I was getting a check, which was, you know, enough for me to survive. But then when their debt reached like $30, $40 million because they were so mismanaged, they sold the company to the other company, and the other company stopped paying me. That's when I had to go to court. And as long as I was going to court, I just brought up the simple fact, hey, they gave me the rights to exploit my video, and then they took it all away. And that didn't look good.
Right.
So now, after 5 years, I had enough energy to go confront this stuff and realized how they had, you know, they had inflicted me with post-traumatic stress disorder and taken advantage of me while I was in distress and just engineered this whole thing and just swooped it all up and blah, blah, blah. And at the end of the line, I'm lucky I got away from them, probably.
Right.
Because I immediately, the first thing I did after I left was I had to get away from High Times, and I started to write a book about the Lincoln assassination. And God damn, I discovered something really amazing. Because of the internet, because of the access to information that exists now, that did not exist when I was a teenager, you can research these events much better, much easier. And there are documents available free at the Library of Congress website that will explain the whole Lincoln assassination. Because there was an investigation by Congress months after the tribunal that hanged those five people. And that investigation proved that the whole tribunal was a fraud supported by perjuries that were paid for. And the people that perjured themselves admitted it. And none of this is in the history books. They act like John Wilkes Booth was a lone assassin.
I mean, yeah, that, like, when you talk about presidential murder conspiracies, assassinations.
You,
like,
wanted to know who killed Kennedy.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, it's just as fascinating to learn that the plot to kill Lincoln involved Jay Gould, who would become the richest man in America, Edwin Stanton, Secretary of War, Lincoln's cabinet member, Ben Wade, the head of the Senate, and Thaddeus Stevens, the head of the House of Representatives. He was killed by his own party. And he was killed right after he'd been reelected. They tried to push him out through an election and ran Salmon Chase against him. And when that failed, they whacked him. Kennedy was killed right before he was going to run for reelection. They didn't even want to go there. They knew he was going to win.
Right. What do you think about our current president of the United States?
Here's the thing. This whole left-right dialectic where they get people to hate each other has reached such a fever pitch. You know, I don't like the president, but I don't like hate speech either. And I don't think it's productive to build your life around hating Donald Trump. New York hates him more than anybody.
Yeah, we all knew. Like, if you're
New
a New Yorker.
New York is a town of immigrants.
Yep.
Okay? So Trump is a populist who is catering to the radical religious right. And he's catering to their scapegoats. And that's how he gets his popularity.
I almost feel like the left gives him his popularity more than the right does.
Yeah, by putting a lot of attention on it.
Yeah, everybody's retweeting it all the time, quote tweeting it,
From the moment he got elected, I never mentioned his name on social media. I never talked about him. And I started blocking people who just went on these tirades. My life is all about hating on Trump.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I found that annoying as hell. You know, but
There's the moments like when the kid they call a neo-Nazi's out at a rally and people are just coming up and punching him in the face. And it begs the question, like, which side are the pacifists anymore? Like, wasn't it like the liberal left, like hippie, we're not like peace, love, dope, and now we're just walking up to people that are in a different political party and punching them in the face?
Yeah, well, they want that wedge. That's the thing. The biggest fear of the Illuminati is that the masses will conspire to vote away their wealth. The way to prevent the masses from conspiring to vote away their wealth is to divide them through wedge issues. And they'll put, the wedge issues will always have a left and a right. So they'll stack up these seven issues, and they'll have, if you're leftist, there's a right answer. If you're a rightist, there's a right answer, but the answers never converge. So then they will inflame these hostilities, and they will create like a Hatfields-type McCoy mentality between these two groups, where there is no common ground, there is no discussion, I hate your fucking guts, you fucking jerk, and that's the dialogue. They want that dialogue,
right.
See? So that's
they're busy fighting. No,
that's what protects them. If we weren't fighting each other, we'd be voting away their wealth.
But now the question becomes, and it's the question that after I read the library you sent me home with on day one, when my syllabus, was what the fuck am I supposed to do then? Right? Like if you can't...
I'm glad you asked me that because I finally figured all that shit out.
Because you leave...
I'm going to be your life coach right
now. Well, you leave the person in the middle
right.
Going...
What? Yeah, exactly. A lot of people told me they were depressed about all this shit. They didn't know what to do.
Elections are bullshit. Yeah. The candidates are bullshit. Everybody's fucking bullshit. So now what?
Okay.
Move.
For a long time, I thought maybe there's going to be an organization. Maybe there'll be a club. Maybe there'll be a society. You know, from the time I was... in grade school, I started my first secret society, the Roaring 21 Club, when I was in fifth grade. So I've been trying to find a community. You know what I mean? So, but now I realize you can join a lot of clubs and communities, but don't make that your life. In fact, don't follow leaders. Don't put your heart and soul in believing somebody's going to change the world or whatever. This is my advice to you, because you're here. You can see what I've done. You can live in paradise right now.
Are you offering me a room?
All you have to do is find a dilapidated shotgun shack. They're all over America. And by the way, they're cheaper than mobile homes. I want you to move into that shotgun shack. I want you to put a privacy 6-foot wall all around the property. This is 1,200 square feet with an 850 square foot house. For two people, that's perfectly okay. If you have a bigger family, you're going to need a slightly bigger compound. But I want you to find that building. I want you to buy that this distressed property. You can do that for as low as $5,000 in some places. And then I want you to slowly transform that place into your dream environment. I want you to put a sauna, a hot tub, a cold tub, an outdoor shower. I want you to put a garden. I want you to have a vegetable garden and a flower garden. I want you to make it a magical place and a refuge from all stress. And as soon as you complete that project, I want you to move in and stay there and build your income and your life as your own boss. This is what I'm doing, and now I realize I should have done this 40 years ago.
So
there is no savior coming for you.
Right.
You know what I mean? Put the compound walls up, get inside, and make your safe zone. And yeah.
And turn off the volume.
Continue to participate, meet people, talk about things. Vote in elections, you know, but don't get caught up. Don't
think you can change it.
Don't think there's this shining knight in shining armor that's coming to rescue you, because those people are manufactured. In almost every case, it's going to be better to have a compassionate person instead of somebody who's, you know, trying to scapegoat people. But the bottom line is the CIA runs the country.
So I've joked about running Prano 2020. But you're telling me, best case scenario, you win, you're the greatest president ever, and they kill you.
You don't get that close.
Yeah, I know. Even in the best.
Here's the funny thing. I don't think the Illuminati ever believed Trump was going to win.
Right.
He wasn't supposed to win. So I think that was kind of a sucker punch in a way, you know. So I don't think Trump expected to win.
I my theory is that the Clintons talked him into running because they didn't think he had a single chance of winning. They just wanted him to cause a little commotion and be their friend on the other side that's rabble-rousing. And then that came back to bite them in the ass.
Yeah, the Democrats had no idea how weak Hillary Clinton was, how hated Trump. Blue Jay. See him?
Yeah.
See the Blue Jay?
Yeah.
I have a thing with birds. We have a lot of birds that hang out here. Phoenix nest.
The Phoenix nest. So that's your advice. Get myself a little compound.
Yeah. And don't run up credit card debt. Don't pay a mortgage. Don't pay rent, for God's sakes. As soon as you can get that compound, and the location is going to depend on your resources. But, you know, like I said, this house flipped for $60,000. Now it's worth over $300,000. So you can do that with sweat equity. You can do that with your fingers.
Right. You said when I walked in that this has been the last year.
The last year, all I did was work on this house. Yeah. Mostly the garden for the last 2 months.
Yeah, the little
garden wasn't here. Until
the tour, we come outside, hot tub, cold tub, April. Sauna, walk through the garden, everything. You gave me the blueprint.
I'm so happy.
Yeah.
My transportation arrives in September. It's a bicycle, tricycle, with a solar panel on top. It's all constructed out of hemp plastic. And it's electric. Like, I have 3 electric bikes, and I have 3 non-electric bikes. So biking is my golf.
Right.
So I'd like to take you on a bike ride.
Sure. I'd love to go on a bike ride.
Yeah. You take some photos. I'll just show you. I mean, I can go in any direction. I can go up hills into mountain trails. I can go along the beaches. I can along the bay, along the river. But
well, that seems like
these are the best bike trails I've ever found.
Seems like a fitting end, Steve. Let's go on a bike ride.
All right.